Well, thank you. Good afternoon. So the presentation is entitled A Great Dilemma because that's what I found really intriguing about my larger project, which looks at the black press and its involvement in first building up the Negro Leagues in close partnership with business owners throughout the East and Midwest, and then the wrenching sacrifice that was forced upon black communities all over, wherever baseball was played, to give up this gem of culture, an institution of black culture and expression, for just a little bit of integration. So in the larger project that I was doing, which chronicled that partnership from the 20s up through the early 50s when the black leagues just kind of fade away, I came upon these really bizarre attempts to save black baseball. And they just, it just made me wonder how these black writers could ever think these fantastical plans could ever work. And so I wanted to find out more and to understand where these ideas came from. So that's what I'm looking at today, this dilemma that in order to integrate baseball, or to begin to integrate baseball, America's black communities throughout the North and Midwest had to sacrifice their own Negro League. So it was a sort of devil's bargain. Now, the black press had labored since the 1930s to force integration. They had been working in the larger plan or mission to force integration since the teens, but in terms of an activist posture of really getting in people's faces, of lobbying baseball officials, I mean mainstream or white baseball officials, that campaign started in the 30s. And in the end, as I said, they had to settle for what? For Jackie Robinson in 1947, for Larry Doby shortly after that, for Satchel Paige shortly after that. But it was 1959 before every team, all 16 teams, had at least one player on their rosters. And many only one, or some say there was an unwritten rule that only two, a team could only have two. So that's what my project looks at, this wrenching sacrifice. And W.E.B. Du Bois called this a double consciousness. And this is what I really found fascinating, because these weird ideas that the black writers came up with is kind of a microcosm or miniature diorama of the larger question for black communities, which was kind of the same dilemma, which is, to what extent do we fight for some integration, some assimilation, and at what cost? And it was a really lopsided bargain or cost for black communities. So these fantastical plans. And here's this is the dilemma that I just talked about, or as W.B. Du Bois called it, the double consciousness. And it's interesting because I just came back from Florence, Italy, where we did a journalism project on the Jews of Florence, or in other words, a minority, meaning minority, a very small minority, 700 Jews in a city of 1.5 million in a Catholic country. And it's the same kind of dilemma. It's the same difficult trade-off of, to what extent do we try to preserve our Jewishness, and then the flip of that, to what extent do we threaten that by being assimilated into mainstream Italian / Roman Catholic culture. So it's an interesting one that recurs. So these fantastical ideas, these ideas that come out of the pages of the black press. In May 1948, the Pittsburgh Courier launches what it called the greatest baseball talent hunt in history. And for even a casual reader of the black press, hyperbole was pretty common, both in promoting something and then in taking credit for whatever happened afterwards. The Courier's primary competitor, the Chicago Defender, sought the very same thing later in the year in August when it announced a national baseball school or academy that it was going to open to produce talent for integration, to fuel integration. So, right, so there's the Pittsburgh Courier's campaign. to preserve the Negro Leagues, and you can see this in the writings of the writers, they understood that part of this meant promoting this separation and then to some extent subordination to the mainstream culture. And yet, as they pushed for integration, you also see a paired impulse to try to save this black institution of black baseball. The two big black weeklies, and I chose the Courier and the Defender, one, because you can access them. Two, they were in succession the largest black weeklies in the country, the Defender first, and then the Weekly. And if you're talking about national campaigns, and both of these wild ideas were supposed to be national, these are the only two papers that could have conceivably pulled it off, right? The Pittsburgh Courier had 14 bureaus throughout the country. The Defender was distributed through Pullman car porters on the railroad system. So these were the only papers that would have even had a chance to do this. But of course, by 1948, the proverbial horse had long since bolted from the barn, right? And that bolting took the form of, as I mentioned, Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella, Satchel Paige, Larry Doby, each donning uniforms in 47, 48, first time for African Americans since Moses Fleetwood Walker took his of the Toledo Blue Stockings in 1879 during Reconstruction. So not surprisingly, both of these plans, the scouting campaign and the academy, were colossal failures, never did anything. The door that Robinson blasted in to Major League Baseball turned out to be a revolving door. Wendell Smith, and he's the guy on the left, longtime sports editor for the Pittsburgh Courier and the first activist for the Courier in the fight for integration, said it this way. He said, the big league doors suddenly opened one day, and when Negro players walked in, Negro baseball walked out. So really everybody turned their attention to Robinson and the Dodgers. Really, that's it, to Robinson and the Dodgers, to the only integrated team there in that season of 1947. So keep in mind, as I mentioned, that integration proved to be a very incremental process. In fact, I don't even know if I'm not sure how to use that word. What is integration, right? Certainly one player on one team, that's not integration. Certainly, even by 1953, there were only nine teams with one black player, at least one black player. So that means seven teams, and 6 years later still don't have even one. So it's a problematic term. But the transfer of loyalty and attention meant that soon after Robinson arrived in Brooklyn, black teams watched their attendance, their business fortunes, everything just fall through the floor. And the black press really contributed to this death spiral. That's what was so interesting to me, because as soon as Robinson joins the Dodgers, well, the writers even called it the Robinson beat. They all wanted to cover the Robinson beat. Fay Young, Wendell Smith, Sam Lacy. And that left really nothing left for coverage, meaningful coverage, of the black leagues, the black teams. So this was something of a, I don't want to call it hypocritical, that's not fair to judge, but certainly at odds with itself, these plans to save black baseball and then what they were actually doing in terms of spending time and resources. So there are many moments I could choose. The one that I like the most to show the shift was in midsummer 1948, Satchel Paige joins the Cleveland Indians, and he pitches in the Mistake by the Lake to a packed crowd, 80,000 plus, in this stadium. And so picture that in one part of your mind's eye, but then picture in the other part of your mind's eye the Cleveland Buckeyes right across town, also playing a home game, coming off one of their best seasons they'd ever had in 1947, and they drew nobody. And in fact, they had to shut down after that 1948 season. So a team, a club, really at the pinnacle of its success, but because no one was going to the games, they shut down. Meanwhile, the Indians draw 2.5 million people that summer with Paige. Now, a few months before Paige's debut, Wendell Smith here announces in a May 48 issue of the Courier a, quote, coast-to-coast talent hunt as part of a larger ambition to create, here's another quote, the greatest scouting system ever devised in the history of baseball. A plan conceived of, here's another quote, the answer to the question owners of Negro teams have been trying to find for many years. That question, how can we find good young ball players? Smith acknowledged a shortage of talent in the black leagues with the hope the national scouting program would fill that gap in a short time. That's another quote. Sponsored by the Courier Sports Department, this, quote, gigantic crowdsourced talent hunt promised $100 to any Courier reader who could produce a bona fide major league ball player talent. $100, if you just use the Consumer Price Index calculator, would have been about $954 in buying power today. So not trivial. Here's another quote from Wendell Smith. We're going into every big city, every small town, even the backwoods of the nation, and uncover these gems. He promised a scouting system, quote, greater than those conducted by the major league clubs. Now, there's no evidence of not one player, no one. There's not evidence of any money being doled out to anyone as a part of this campaign. What's also interesting about this, okay, so there was no race requirement. These were not, they weren't just looking for black players, they were looking for ball players. That's interesting. And that's a cue or a window into maybe what was really going on, which is, yes, and Smith said, what was, I have a quote from him speaking to the, yeah, okay, so I'll get to it. A quote that claims innocence in this campaign, that the motivations are pure to save black baseball. But what was also going on here? Money, right? Here's a chance to make some money. Major League Baseball was beginning to pay contracts. Ricky infamously paid nothing for Robinson, just essentially stole him from the Kansas City Monarchs, putting the Monarchs in a really difficult situation. Are the Monarchs going to stop, you know, Robinson from going to Brooklyn over money? Of course not. They can't do that. But with Bill Veeck and Larry Doby, they start paying for the talent, for the players. So the black owners suddenly see, the black writers suddenly see a new revenue stream, possibility for money. So this opportunism, especially from Smith, shouldn't surprise, because in 1947, and see, okay, so there's a new movie coming out, 42, right? They just finished filming just up the highway from my house up in Chattanooga, old Rickwood Field. They had just come from Englefield. They had just come from Rickwood Field in Birmingham, 42, with Harrison Ford as Branch Rickey. So when I saw that was happening, my first thought was, after seeing several accounts of that 47 season, is there going to be a black sports writer in the movie, right? Is there going to be anything said of the connection that Wendell Smith made for Branch Rickey, introducing him to Jackie Robinson? Ricky was asking about Page. Ricky was asking about some other top pitchers, and it's Wendell Smith who said, no, Mr. Rickey, with all due respect, you want an everyday player. You want someone out there every day carrying this banner, not a once every 5 days. Is he going to be in the movie? I don't think he's going to be in the movie. So, but back to my point, Smith was put on the payroll of the Dodgers for $50 a week to go ahead of Robinson and find housing in the segregated cities like St. Louis, to just be a companion, a traveling companion on the railways, rail cars, because, you know, of course, especially through the first half of the season, he wasn't going to have any white friends on the team. So that basically doubled his pay. He made 50 a week, always had made 50 a week as the sports editor for the Courier, and then also 50 a week for the Dodgers. So the PR spin was, let's save black ball. The reality was, yeah, maybe some of that, I'm sure a lot of that, because I think there's some guilt here on the part of black writers who realized they were killing this beautiful thing, but also it was, let's make some money. Okay, so to some historical context, which is the symbol there on the right. So where did these weird ideas come from? Well, it's just a theory, but I think it's a good one, that the idea to establish a national scouting campaign, the template for that, the credentials for that, the network, the grassroots network for that, is in the Double V campaign that the Pittsburgh Courier very successfully set up during World War II, saying victory abroad, yes, against fascism and Nazism, but, excuse me, how about some democracy back at home, right? Why can't we have equal rights also in employment? If someone can die on the battlefields of Germany, why can't they play in center field for a white team? So this campaign was very, very successful nationally. So it established something of a template or a model for Smith. Okay, so the Courier, and that's this slide here, the Courier included in the same issue of its announcement that they were going to do the National Scouting Campaign, reactions from the black team owners. So that's interesting from a timing standpoint. What does that tell us? If the announcement of the campaign appears the same time as the reactions to the announcement of the campaign, there's an awful lot of cooperation, collaboration, collusion would be a negative term, going on behind the scenes, right? There were no reactions from anybody in Major League Baseball, but it did include these from, so here on the left you have the owners of the Negro National and Negro American Leagues, J.B. Martin there on the left and his brother right there in the middle. J.B. Martin, president of the Negro American League, said the program would help every team in baseball. Vernon Green, owner of the Baltimore Elite Giants, was relieved. He said, I'm glad to know that someone is going to help us find ball players. And Effa Manley, now she was a hard woman to please. Effa Manley, co-owner of the Newark Eagles, said the plan will be a lifesaver. And Abe Saperstein, owner of the Harlem Globetrotters and also a scout, one of the first integration-minded scouts for the Cleveland Indians, called it a can't-miss. Did these owners notice that in the same issue of the Courier, there was no coverage, none, zero, of the Black Leagues? I don't know. Maybe they did. Maybe they didn't. So Smith led that sports section and then three other issues with this, the announcement of this big campaign. And then it just vanishes, just disappears. And then much later in the year, in September, Smith writes this. So 5 months after the Talent Hunt's official launch, he says, Negro talent just can't be found, and we're going to have to wait until the kids playing in the sandlots around the country develop. Without mentioning the campaign by name. All right, so just have a few minutes left, so let me switch over to the Chicago Defender, which had also a really bizarre idea, which was this National Baseball Academy. Where did that idea come from? Well, once again, the Defender had a historical precedent, context, grassroots network, credentials, a template for doing something like this, which were the Bud Billiken clubs established, well, even in the Caribbean and the West Indies, as far as that, but also throughout the United States. So they had a network for this. Either that, or it might have been Alan Page, a sports promoter down in New Orleans, who was president at the time of the Negro Southern League, a black semi-pro league, who also had that plan to come up with a national baseball academy. Okay, so moving along, I've got evidence, lots of evidence, of the shift in coverage. Blanket coverage of Robinson and of black players in the major leagues, very little. In fact, reading between the lines, it's press release-driven coverage of the black teams. Whatever they sent in to the paper would rerun. So, with just a few minutes, then it just gets kind of sad, right? Okay, thanks. You have women, and nothing against women, right? But women were used as a publicity stunt to attract fans, with Tony Stone, Connie Morgan, Mamie Johnson, comedy acts of the Indianapolis Clowns, right? It just became a bit burlesque. And then I just love the comment by Sam Lacey about all of this, that, you know, it was both mainstream whites and blacks who were deprived. Blacks for obvious reasons, but whites never. We never got to see Oscar Charleston glide through the outfield. We never got to see Satchel Paige's Midnight Creeper. We never got to see Gibson's Ruthian home runs, or as the black fans called Ruth's home runs, Gibsonian home runs. These are the visions that dance in my head. Thanks.
Do we have any questions for Brian?
Guy in the blue.
Yeah, what kind of scouting apparatus does Negro League teams have at the time? And how in the world would the newspapers seriously hope to find players that the Negro Leagues themselves wouldn't?
Right. That's a great question, and I don't think they did. I mean, this obviously wasn't thought through very carefully. Wendell Smith, who had relationships, dialogues with officials in Major League Baseball, from Branch Rickey to the Pittsburgh Pirates to the commissioner's office itself, no evidence of any conversation or collaboration or planning before all of this. So I think that's a great question. The Negro Leagues weren't scouting much either. They were on shoestring budgets, just trying to make it week to week. And here's the interesting thing to your question: Major Leagues just started skipping the Negro Leagues. Didn't want to worry. Similar to the debate about can college players today make the transition from aluminum bats to wood bats, and et cetera. Then it was, could a black player transition from the style of the Negro Leagues and the inconsistencies to Major League Baseball? So they just went straight to the colleges. That's a great question.
Over there.
Yeah. The Negro League teams did a lot of hard stories. I mean, they played games between league games.
Yes.
And so one would think that they would have a scouting mechanism in place, the team itself. Playing teams that they had these unscheduled games against.
Yes.
They could identify good ball
players. Yeah. No, that's a great point, and really true. One of the teams that I look at in a totally different project in Wichita, a team in Wichita, the Monrovians, that played the Ku Klux Klan in 1930. Anyway, that was interesting. Yeah, so when the Kansas City Monarchs rolled through town, they saw T.J. Young, Thomas Jefferson Young, playing catcher, and like, this kid is great, and they signed him up. So you're absolutely right. It just wasn't very systematic, and it was every man for himself.
Good question. The left side.
Yeah. One has to wonder about efforts like find the greatest player ever. It seemed like in the black press was very, very good at creating campaigns for self-promotion, like the Buck Millikan Day Parade in Chicago, for example. Back to school events, things of that nature. One has to wonder if it wasn't more publicity driven for the newspapers to increase circulation rather than baseball driven to find the greatest player ever.
So questioning the motives behind some of this?
Yeah, I think being a bit familiar with the black press in that period,
sure.
It's like an effort to promote the newspaper more than baseball itself. In
a way. Right, yeah. But the black teams were doing the same. I mean, they were. So the black press was one of maybe the four or five top businesses in black communities of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, with funeral homes, with baseball teams, with banking and insurance companies. So they were trying to do that. But to say Bud Billiken was just a circulation motivated move, no, I think that's grossly inaccurate, unfair. Not saying you're saying that, but the Bud Billiken parades still go on today, still a very important expression of the black community in the south side of Chicago and certainly through the World War, both wars, one and two. Yes, the black papers were opportunistic, definitely. Was that their only goal or only motivation? That's what's interesting. No, I don't think so. I think there really was this sense of, in the case of the project here, guilt. Oh my gosh, we're killing. They always called it the golden goose. It's laying the golden egg. We're killing the goose. We got to save the goose. at the same time that everybody, including the reporters themselves, are going into major league ballparks instead of black teams.
Last question.
Did you look at the Kansas City Call or the other black papers?
The Call did not have a plan like this, did not try to hatch a national plan like this. So, yeah, definitely I read the Call throughout the period. And my book, When to Stop the Cheering, came out in 2007, includes, you know, all of the black papers. This project, I just focused on these Hakamimi plans that I had come across in reading all of those other newspapers.
Well, we're out of time on questions, but if you have any more questions, you can talk with Brian outside the room.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you for taking a look at the Negro version of the forerunner of reality shows such as American Idol and America's Got Talent.
Is this your plan that I have?
Coming up at 3:30, we will have a presentation from Mark Harmer.
Is this your pen that I have here?
No, it isn't.
Presentation.